Okay, well, if you'd be kind enough to turn to Luke chapter 6, that's where we're going to start out this morning. Welcome, everybody. And we're in Our God is Conditional, part 3. And the subtitle is Walk, Don't Just Take a Step. Okay, and we're going to see some example conditional clauses today, eventually. But we're going to start out in Luke chapter 6. So we're in part 3 today, so we're going to be looking at some example conditional clauses, and we're going to start to build on the foundation of where we've got to so far in this series. But today I want to continue building some of the foundation of this subject, because foundation, as we all know, is absolutely critical if we're going to build anything. Yeah. We have to be really aware that anything we do and learn is only as good as its foundation. I mean, just ask a builder. Yeah, a builder will tell you, and I know we've got some people considering building in our assembly, but a builder will tell you, if you ask him, what's the most important part of a house? He's going to say, oh, any house is only as good as its foundation. Yeah. No matter what you build on top of it, no matter what the quality of the workmanship that you build a house, unless that foundation is firm, you're in trouble. So let's hear briefly here in Luke 6 from the master builder, yeah, Jesus Christ himself. Look at what he says here in Luke 6 and in verse 46. Now watch the way he starts out here. Why do you call me Lord, Lord? And then what? And do not do. Do you notice there's two do's there? Do not do what I say. Yeah, and we've been seeing now for weeks, if not months, the importance of not listening necessarily to what people are saying. Yeah, but look at what they're doing. Tells you so much more in life than anything you hear and they say. Yeah, look at first verse 47. Everyone who comes to me and hears my words and what? Acts on them. So there's a hearing involved and there's an action involved. And acts on them. But you see, it's not just hearing the words. Yeah? Unless there's a corresponding action, we're not really in line with the Lord. Remember the way this section started out? Yeah? Why do you call me Lord? Lord. Yeah? He's nailing this in some people's lives. So it's not just hearing the words. I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man building a house who dug deep and laid a foundation on the rock. And when a flood occurred, the torrent burst against that house and could not shake it. Because, watch that now, because it had been well built. Now I want you to keep in mind what the subject matter that we're going into again today, these conditional clauses. We've got to build this subject, as is the case with any subject, on a firm foundation and understanding of the scriptures. Yeah? But not just the scriptures, also grammar. We've got to start to understand some of the basics, right? Verse 49. But the one who has heard, so again, this person's hearing the same stuff. Get it? It's not that they're not hearing in this example that the Lord's giving. They're hearing the same things, but has not acted. So there's no corresponding action, having heard the same stuff, yeah, but no corresponding action. He is like a man who built a house on the ground without any foundation. And the torrent burst against it, and immediately it collapsed. And the ruin of that house was what? Great. Why? Because they lost everything. Yeah? Because they didn't build, or he didn't build, on the rock. And that's so, so essential for us. particularly as we go into these subjects on conditional clauses. We've got to understand some of the foundations that we're building on in this subject. Yeah. And you'll see that as we go through this. Now, some of these conditional clauses are very apparent in the scriptures, and some really, you know, some of them really stand out, and we've looked at a couple of them. You know, Matthew 18, remember Genesis? Genesis 2, yeah? Some of them are very apparent, but others, you've got to be really attentive to pick them up as time goes on. They're going to start standing out to you a lot more as you read the scriptures, and as I mentioned, that's one of my objectives as we get through this. Now, I mentioned in part one how lawyers view conditional clauses. Do you remember that? How seriously these professional lawyers approach conditional clauses. Now, most so-called Christians don't approach these conditional clauses with any focus. Yeah? Many are totally unaware of them, and if any of them see them, they don't take them seriously. And one of the main reasons for that is they're being taught, have you ever heard this phrase? Once saved, always saved. Yeah? Taught it for decades. They've been brainwashed into thinking that once they take a step, catching on to the title now, once they take a step, that's it. And if that was the truth, we wouldn't bother with this whole series. It would be totally irrelevant because there will be no consequences. Wouldn't that be great? No consequences for not taking the conditions seriously. But that's where the majority and the many are today. Live any way you want because it's all going to work out great in the end anyway. Yeah? The phrase, eat, drink and be merry, comes to mind. Remember that phrase? It's in that great chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, 32. Yeah. If there's no resurrection, hey, let's let it go. Eat, drink, be merry. Do whatever you like. There's not going to be any consequences. Well, we're going to start learning in the scriptures that there are so many conditional clauses that warrant our attention, our serious, serious attention. And I said in part one, I mentioned, as to say, how lawyers handle these conditional clauses. Now, I'm going to read an article from a professional firm, lawyer firm website to give you some indication of this. And this website basically says it all in terms of how serious the legal practices take these conditional clauses. So I'm going to quote some of their info. So just listen up now to the heading. If you hear nothing else but the heading, it should really get your attention. Yeah. Quoting now, and I'm going to leave the link in there so you can see where I quoted it from, because I'm not going to read it all. But listen to this as I quote this heading. Quote, conditional clauses cause contractual chaos. End of quote. That's the heading. That's the heading from people in the world who are dealing with legal contracts. Conditional clauses cause contractual chaos. Yeah? So just listen up to their attitude towards conditional clauses here. You ready now? I'm quoting this from their website. So hope you're attentive. Quote, it is no secret that contractual drafting can be a nightmare. Even the smallest grammatical error can change the meaning and effect of a contractual clause. And one ill-considered word could jeopardize the validity of the entire contract. Some contracts contain, quote, conditional clauses, end of quote, which mandate that certain events must occur or conditions be fulfilled before the contract is binding or enforceable. These clauses can have significant impacts upon the effect and enforceability of a contract. End of quote. This is in the context of a particular case, and I'm not going to read the case, but I'm going to leave the link in there so you can read the case, because it's really interesting, because they lose the case because of conditional clauses at great cost. Yeah. But what I am going to read is the verdict of the case. And as I say, the case was actually lost at a huge cost when the conditional clauses were ignored and not fulfilled. So here's the verdict now, right? Quoting again. This case serves as an important warning to potential contracting parties to read the contract carefully before signing. Yeah? Keeping an eye out for any, quote, conditional, end of quote, or, quote, subject to, end of quote, clauses. It is also important to be cognizant of the effect of these clauses, as courts are likely to give full effect to the ordinary language, while many render the contract unenforceable until such conditions are fulfilled. Wow. That sums up how urgent the subject that we're looking into is, or what. Yeah. As I say, I'm going to leave the link in there. You can read about the whole case. Really, really interesting in the whole context of what we're getting into. So that gives us a great insight into the legal world's view of conditional clauses, doesn't it? It's really serious for them. Yeah? I would suggest it's the first thing they go through in a contract. What are the conditions? What must be met? What are the subjects we have to meet? What is involved in these subjects? Yeah? Which is in direct contrast to the so-called Christian view. Yeah? Bear that in mind. Where it is extensively taught that God is totally unconditional and that these conditional clauses can effectively be ignored as they're powerless and therefore come with no consequences. Yeah? Nothing could be further from the truth. But do we understand and realize what we're surrounded by? Sometimes we don't catch on to how serious this is. And we're going to be seeing it through the weeks to come. We're going to catch on. That's my goal, that every one of us catch on to how serious each of these conditional clauses are. Now, I want to stress again, it's not us seeing these conditional clauses and sentences that is so critical, but us taking the appropriate action. Yeah? You've got to get that. The Lord wants us to get it. That's why he spent time in Luke 6 saying what he said. Yeah? It's our actions in our lives concerning them that's so, so important for every one of us to take seriously. Just got to read Luke 6 and read it over and over again. Get it into our heads. Because remember in Luke 6, the wise guy what? Acted. And the idiot didn't act accordingly. Remember that? Just read it. And his loss was what? Great. You want your loss to be great? Go right ahead. Don't act on the words you hear. Just go through life thinking you're the exception to it. Yeah? And your loss will be great and my loss will be great. Now, remember last week I mentioned the danger of us superimposing these conditional clauses and the consequences onto others. Yeah? So easy to do that. And I told you, and I told myself, take it personally. Don't look and don't think about, oh yeah, I know that, if, you know, the people I know are living this way. No, no. Look in the mirror and make sure we're not living this way. Yeah? Got to take it seriously. Got to really, really understand this subject. Because we're constantly battling against our old religious teaching and thinking. And many of us don't think we are because, oh no, we're in an assembly now that teaches the truth. Well, we're still impacted by it. I've been going on for months about complacency and apathy. That can creep into our lives. We've got to be serious. We've got to take it seriously. Don't think about tomorrow. Oh, I'll get it together tomorrow. Who promised you tomorrow? I want to know the name. Because he never promised anyone life tomorrow. Yeah? And one of the reasons is that most so-called Christian doctrines teach there are no consequences for someone who says, yeah, who says, oh, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. And what they're hearing is, you know, they say, as long as you say it, yeah, everything will work out good in the end. That's what we're surrounded by. It's got nothing to do with what you say or what I say. And everything to do with what we do. That's where the Lord said, do not do what I say. Yeah, it's all about our actions of life, not about what we say. Got to get that. Again, nothing could be further from the truth. Yeah. Because people may think because they, quote, believed, end of quote, something one day, years ago. Yeah. I remember that day. I was 16. So what? Yeah. If I live in hell from 16 onwards, doesn't matter what I said. My actions, I will be judged on my actions at the judgment seat of Christ. Not about what I said decades ago. And believe me, it was decades ago when I was 16. Yeah. Because it's called a walk of faith for a reason. God could have just as easily said, oh, just take a step of faith. Because that's what you hear today in the many religious systems of this world. Oh, just take a step. Where the heck would we be if Abraham just took a step? Or anybody else. Oh, Jesus. Oh, just take a step, Jesus. Would you have your salvation today if it was just a step he took? No, none of us would. And neither will we see salvation into the kingdom if we just are fully dependent on a step that we took. Yeah? God called it a walk of faith for a reason. Yeah? Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Just in case you think I made it up. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. For we walk by faith, not by sight. Verse 7. Yeah, 2 Corinthians 5:7. For we walk by faith. We what? Why didn't he put a step in there? It'd be so much easier. No, it's a walk. Yeah? Boy, I'm so glad Abraham didn't just take a step. Just think of the outcome. How different the outcome for all of us would have been if that was the case. Now, your local pastor might call it a step. Yeah? But the scriptures don't. The truth is, it's a long walk of endurance to the end. And by the way, not an easy walk either. We've all chosen easy walks, haven't we? You know, the downhill ones. No uphill. They're fantastic. Could do that every day. But it's not a downhill walk. In fact, it's mostly an uphill grind. Don't you love these walks? Because all you have to do is ask the cloud of believers in Hebrews 11, when you see them, if you and I see them in the kingdom, how was that easy walk that you took? Yeah. It's depicted in the scriptures. It's not an easy walk. Now, last week, we went over some of the standard grammatical aspects of this subject of conditional clauses, conditional sentences. Now, I want to highlight these this week from a biblical scholar's perspective, yeah, as I want us to have an all-round understanding of this subject, both in terms of how the world views it, in terms of, you know, we looked at lawyers, but also the grammatical aspects we've looked at from a world's perspective. And one of the best biblical scholars who studied this subject in great depth was a man called James L. Boyer, B-O-Y-E-R. Yeah. He was a professor of theology, Grace Theological Seminary, I believe. He's now dead. I believe he died in 2003 at a ripe old age. But I want to recognize him, and I'm going to leave a link in the notes as well so you can read a bit more about him. He was, as I say, a professor emeritus at Grace Theological Seminary, but he took this subject and really studied it in great depth, with a great depth of the Greek language as well, yeah, which I don't have, but he certainly did. Yeah. So I'm quoting some of his work here as we go through this, just to give us a perspective, an overall view of the subject, yeah, so we can get some perspective on it. And I'm not going into a lot of detail on this. You can go into a lot of detail on it. The links will be there. You can study this subject probably for the rest of your life, you know, and I look forward to hearing what any of you do on this subject, yeah. But here's some of his work that I'm going to quote from his work. This inductive study of the approximately 300 New Testament instances of the first class condition, A plus indicative, and we'll get into this, epsilon iota is translated if. So if plus the indicative disputes the common understanding that this construction should be interpreted as obviously true and translated as since. Now, there are articles about the dispute among theologians about whether this term should be translated if or since. Yeah. And the resounding clarion call from most of them is that it, and particularly from James Boyer, is that it should be if, yeah. And just, I used a word there, indicative, which, the indicative mood, that what that does is it presents the action of the event as something real or certain, in other words, as an objective fact, yeah. So that's a really condensed understanding of that word. So, going on to quote him again, it is found that this is the case only, and he's referring to what he just said, you know, translated as since. It is found that this is the case only 30% of the time. Surprisingly, in 51% of the occurrences, the condition is undetermined. Four proposed explanations of this construction are examined and found to be inadequate. It is then argued that the correct explanation of the first class condition is a simple logical connection between the protasis and the apodosis. Remember that from last week? Yeah. Continuing with him. The consideration primarily involved in this study is the relation to reality. The relation to reality expressed in the D plus indicative protasis. The condition, yeah. This was carefully appraised, listed, and tabulated with the following results. So they went through, or he went through, 300 instances of this particular instance of the word if, the A plus the indicative, yeah, and found these statistics, yeah. I'll probably leave these in the notes. Number one. Instances where the condition was obviously true. Now, this is really important, right? When it comes to these conditional clauses, we can't just read over them. We've got to start to understand the weight of evidence and the weight that it's given in the scriptures. So, instances where the condition was obviously true was 115 instances where the condition was obviously true. That was 37% out of the 300, right? Number two, instances where the condition was obviously false. 36 instances where the condition was obviously false. That was 12% of the total. Number three, instances where the condition was undetermined. 155. That's 51%. So it's really important when you look at the conditions, what the truth behind that condition is, yeah, and the understanding. And under that heading three, instances where the condition was undetermined, he's given five different categories. Number one, uncertain by reason of futurity, something that was future, which was five. There was five instances where the uncertainty was by the reason of futurity. And that, again, that was 2%. Number two, uncertain by reason of providence, i.e. the course of events. Yeah, there was 24 instances, which was equivalent to 8%. Number three, uncertain by reason of man's spiritual condition. There was 38 of these. Again, 12%. Number four, uncertain by reason of man's actions or choices. 72 instances where that condition was dependent on a man's actions or choices. 24%. And number five, last but not least, uncertain by reason of man's ignorance or doubt. 16 instances where the condition was uncertain by reason of man's ignorance or doubt, 16, which is equivalent to 5%. So as I say, you can review that, but I think it starts to give us a different view of conditional clauses. They're not just straightforward, right? There's a lot of different instances that we have to be familiar with and aware of, right? And I'm quoting here a quote from a chap called Goodwin, but he quotes, "When the protasis simply states a particular supposition, implying nothing as to the fulfillment of the condition, it has the indicative with A." Yeah, so I'll leave that in the notes as well, because that becomes more and more significant. So just one last paragraph I want to quote from Boyer. So quoting him, "In summary, what does a first-class conditional sentence in New Testament Greek mean? It means precisely the same as the simple condition in English. Quote, if this, then that. End of quote. If this, then that. So I'm really simplifying it down as he does. And he's great. I mean, he's obviously a very qualified Greek scholar, but he tends to simplify things in English to make it so much easier to understand if we're not Greek scholars. So if this, then that, it implies, continuing, it implies absolutely nothing as to, quote, the relation to reality, end of quote. Okay? So it implies absolutely nothing as to the, quote, relation to reality, end of quote. It is saying that the result, the apodosis, yeah, the result is as sure as the condition, the protasis. That's really important. It is a forceful device of language which leaves the judgment and the convictions of the hearer with regard to the truthfulness of the supposition to prove or disprove and to enforce the truth of the conclusion. These statements can be made of every one of the 300 New Testament examples and are equally true of every one of them." Yeah. So we're going to be going through some of these and seeing and understanding that, but I feel, and it's important to understand, it's not just straightforward, right? So you've got to be aware, as I say, even on a cursory level, of these instances of the fluctuation and the variance in these clauses. So these are some of the concepts that we have got to be aware of, some of the truths regarding these. And also, I want to point this one out, and that is actuality or truth is not the significance of first-class conditions. Actuality or truth is not the significance of first-class conditions. And here are some clear examples. So we have to remember, just because we're reading a first-class condition does not necessarily imply truth or reality. Yeah? And the context will always be the deciding factor, as is so often the case for us all. Yeah? The context determines it. So here's a clear example, Matthew 5. Go to Matthew 5. One we're very familiar with. Hey, first word, 29. If. Yeah, we're going to be reading if a lot over the next few weeks. Yeah. If you're, you got Matthew 5, 29, yeah. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now, what's the Lord expecting all his audience to be poking their eyes out or cutting their hands off? That wasn't the reality, was it? Because it depends, the truth or the fact and the reality depends on how the eye and the hand is being used, doesn't it? But it's clear the eye and the hand are not the issue, is it? You know, just because you've got two eyes doesn't mean you need to poke one out in order to avoid hell. And you've got to understand that reference to hell as well. But it's clear the eye and the hand are not the issue, right? It's all in how the eye and the hand is being used. Get that? Which, of course, stems from where? The mind of the person. The Lord was referring to those who were sinning with their eyes and sinning with their hands and saying, hey, if it's your eye that's doing it, if it's your hand that's doing it, get rid of it. But he wasn't saying that as reality. All the disciples weren't one-eyed and walking about with one hand. Get it? Yeah? But you see the way it can be abused in so many ways, right? The point being here is, no matter what it takes, disciples, no matter what it takes, follower, no matter what the cost is to you, the cost of your eye, the cost of your hand, do it. Yeah, do it. Back to the acting again. Yeah. Why do you not do what I do? Why do you not do what I do? That's the point he was trying to get across. Now, here's another good example. Remember Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane? Remember that? Matthew 26. Matthew 26, 39. So these are just a couple of examples just to bring some balance into understanding some of these conditional clauses. So Matthew 26, 39. And he went a little beyond them and fell on his face and prayed, saying, my Father, if, there it is, eh? If it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will. So Jesus is praying for something, conditioning it on the possibility. Do you see that? But watch what he says next. Really important. Matthew 26, 42, verse 42, jump down to 42. He went away again a second time and prayed, saying, my Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, your will be done. So there's no way these both can be true. Why? Because they're the complete opposite, aren't they? They're the complete opposite. God's ultimate will had to be done. But he was putting that if out there as a possibility. Get it? So I hope you're starting to see a little bit of the variance you've got to have, that open-mindedness you've got to have when you go into these if a conditional clauses. Yeah, it's really important. Because there's a number of these kind of nuances to these first-class conditions, and at least, at a minimum, we should be at least aware of them. Yeah, at least aware of them. But one of the main things to be aware of is that actually a truth is not the significance of first-class conditions. Yeah. So let me finish this point with this example. Go to Matthew 12. Matthew 12. So all I'm trying to do is broaden our minds, yeah, when we look at conditions and understand there's nuances, there's variance in them, yeah. Well, Matthew 12, verse 27. Verse 27. If, here we go, are you ready? If I by, this is the Lord talking, by the way. If I by Beelzebul cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out? For this reason, they will be your judges. But if I cast out demons by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. Get it? There is no way in heaven he was casting out demons by Beelzebul. Is there? But the if condition is there. 1 Corinthians 15 again. 1 Corinthians 15 and in verse 13, here's another example. I'm sure I covered this in Life is Only in the Resurrection, but here it is. 1 Corinthians 15, 13. But if, yeah, but if there is no resurrection of the dead, not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain. Your faith also is in vain. Now cast your mind back to what I read earlier. Yeah? Remember I read it earlier. I think it was in section 2 that I mentioned of what he said. Where he said, instances where the condition was obviously false. Remember that? There was 36 of them. 12% of the 300. Yeah? There's an instance where the condition is obviously false. Because there is going to be a resurrection. And Christ has been raised. Get it? So you've got to see these nuances. We've got to understand and be aware of them. They're not just straightforward. You don't just read it and say, there is no resurrection. No. This is an instance where it's obviously false. But it's something we need to be aware of as we read. Yeah. Because remember, one of my objectives is that as we read the scriptures, we're picking these out. We're starting to watch out for them. And these are some of the nuances you need to be aware of when you do that. Yeah. But sometimes these conditions can be a bit more subtle. Listen up to this next section. And remember we started out in Matthew 18. That was a pretty obvious one. Unless you come like this little child, you ain't going to enter the kingdom of God. Remember that? Very obvious conditional clause. And remember Genesis 2, another obvious one. But here's one that's not maybe quite as obvious. Colossians 1. And we're going to finish off here in Colossians 1. Colossians 1, 21. And although you were formerly alienated and hostile in mind, engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death. In order. Purpose. Right? In order to present you before him holy and blameless and beyond reproach. Now many people reading this stop right there and say, oh man, I took that step. Can't quite remember when it was. It was decades ago. But I took that step. I remember grabbing a Bible from the altar. And walking back to my seat. Oh, I held my hand up in the meeting. Yeah. And now I'm holy and blameless and beyond reproach. Fantastic. I'm ready to go, as they say. Yeah. Now listen up to the context. Because again, it's a great verse, but listen to the context. Listen up to the condition coming up. Right in the same context. Because if none of us meet this condition coming up, none of us will be presented holy and blameless and beyond reproach. So we better meet the condition coming up. But do you see what most people do? They'll either stop at verse 22 or they will continue to read it and gloss over the conditional clause. Happens all the time. That's assuming they even read the Bible. Yeah. Verse 23. Here comes the condition. You ready? Listen up now. Because we all want to be holy, blameless, and what was it? Without reproach, beyond reproach. Yeah. Verse 23. If the Canadians should pick up that Greek word easily. If indeed you continue in the faith, firmly established and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel that you have heard, which is proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, was made a minister. Does that sound like a step to anybody? It's not. It's an enduring walk to the end. Because that's when salvation turns up. Not the moment you take a wander down the aisle. Or you decide to stick your hand up in a meeting. Or do a verse that's taken out of context. Now, I'm saying all this stuff, but do you know that's what I did for years? Decades. Because remember the uphill trek I mentioned? There it is right there. Yeah. The trek that we're all on, guys. The trek on the narrow path leading to the narrow gate. Do you notice how narrow it is? Do you notice the amount of elbow room on this path we're on? You can be claustrophobic and be in our assembly. There's so few of us. Get it? So let me all ask you another rhetorical question. What if I don't? What if I don't? What if I don't? What if you and I do not continue in the faith established and steadfast? Yeah. Oh, I'll be presented holy and blameless and beyond reproach anyway. Regardless, no, you and I will not. Get it? And all we're doing is actually reading what's written. And you think to yourself, man, we can't be the only ones that see this, surely. It's few. It's few. As bizarre as that is to say, it is few. Yeah. Again, it's that veil thinking. Again, my term. The veil thinking I mentioned last week. So we'll pick it up from here. Next week, we will continue. Okay? Amen.